Well, thank you for that lovely introduction, Catherine. And yes, I am a proud supporter of this particular cause. It's actually a tradition of the Governor of the Reserve Bank to give this annual address, and I'm very happy to continue it. Whoops. We actually heard from Bessa about the foundation and its support of research into depression, adolescent depression and suicide. It is a widespread issue, and I think most of us in this room have been touched by it at some point. And so I'm therefore very pleased to be speaking at an event in support of such an important cause. So what I want to do is start today by explaining the Board's most recent policy decision and summarise our central outlook for the Australian economy as we set it out in the August Statement on Monetary Policy. To a large extent, I'm going to be reinforcing many of the points I made after the August Board meeting. So as I'm sure you know, at its meeting in early August, the Board decided to leave the cash rate unchanged at 4.35%. While inflation has fallen substantially since its peak, it is still some way above the midpoint of the 2-3% target range, with underlying inflation, as measured by the TRIM mean, at 3.9% in June. The Board is trying to bring inflation back to target in a reasonable timeframe while preserving as many of the gains in the labour market that we have seen in the past few years as possible. And this is the so-called narrow path, as my predecessor Phil described it. Now, in our central August forecast, underlying inflation is expected to be back in the target range by the end of next year and to approach the midpoint in 2026. Now, that's a slightly slower return to target than we had forecast in May. Meanwhile, the labour market remains relatively tight, but we expect it to continue to ease gradually over the next couple of years. Now, there's substantial uncertainty around this central outlook, with risks on both sides. And one way to think about this is to consider the historical errors around our central forecasts, and we represent that as fan charts in the Statement on Monetary Policy, and you see that in this graph. There are so many things that could happen that could result in inflation being above or below the central forecast. The central forecast is just the central forecast. The statement in August also provided some specific scenarios under which consumption and employment could be stronger or weaker than implied by our central forecasts. And these scenarios illustrate that outcomes for inflation could be quite different if the economy follows an alternative path. The Board needs to be alert to these possibilities in thinking about the future path of interest rates. In setting policy, the Board's looking to strike an appropriate balance between the RBA's inflation and full employment objectives. Given the starting point of high inflation and a relatively tight labour market, and that low and stable inflation ultimately supports our full employment objective, our highest priority has been and remains to bring inflation down. And I'll come back to say a bit about why later. The Board remains vigilant to upside risks to inflation and has noted that monetary policy will need to remain sufficiently restrictive until it's confident that inflation is moving sustainably towards the target range. Moreover, the forecasts I've described were predicated, as usual, on the technical assumption that the cash rate follows the path implied by the market at the time. This meant that our central forecast for inflation, as seen in this chart, was based on cuts in the cash rate starting early next year. So the Board's message following its meeting only a few weeks ago was that it's premature to be thinking about rate cuts. Circumstances may, of course, change, and if economic conditions don't evolve as expected, the Board will respond accordingly. But if the economy evolves broadly as anticipated, the Board does not expect it will be in a position to cut rates in the near term. Now, I now want to talk through recent developments in inflation in a bit more detail, explain why it's important to complete the job of getting inflation down, and I'll say a few words about the resilience of household finances to high inflation and the tightening in monetary policy that's occurred in response. So what's driving inflation now? This chart shows contributions of various parts of the consumer price inflation basket compared to their average contribution over the entire inflation targeting period. And this helps us to identify which parts of the CPI basket drove the rise in inflation in 2022 and the subsequent easing in inflation. So you can see that through 2022 and 2023, most components of the CPI basket were growing faster than usual. Inflation in housing and goods prices was particularly high over that period. But over the past 18 months, goods price inflation has declined substantially as supply disruptions associated with the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in the Ukraine have subsided and global demand for goods has eased. Inflation for retail goods, consumer durables and groceries, is now close to its historical average. Inflation for administered prices, so these are prices that are at least partly regulated or they relate to items for which the public sector is a significant provider, inflation there is only a little above its long-run average. The key drivers, I think you'll see from this chart, the key drivers of elevated inflation at the moment are housing costs and market services inflation. They remain above their average levels and they've been easing only gradually. On the housing side, this reflects both construction cost growth and strong increases in rents. Year-ended growth in advertised rents is still high. This reflects a pressure from a rebound in housing demand and limited supply response. Rents on new leases take time to impact overall CPI rents because only a small share of the stock of rental properties update leases in a given month. So CPI rent inflation is likely to remain high for some time. New dwelling inflation has declined from its earlier peak as materials costs have eased, but it remains elevated. There's still a large pipeline of work and there's ongoing labour shortages for certain trades. Now, market services is making the largest contribution to above target inflation. While year-ended inflation has been moderating across most market services, particularly those that are more discretionary, such as eating out or recreational activities, inflation in this category remains high at 5.3% over the year to the June quarter. So we typically think of market services inflation as reflecting overall domestic cost inflationary pressures, a combination of costs and margins. Domestic non-labour costs, including, for example, electricity, insurance, and warehousing and logistics rents, these all continue to increase strongly. And labour cost growth is also strong, reflecting both wage increases and weak productivity growth. Survey measures, such as in the RBA's liaison program, suggest that firms are continuing to pass through some of this cost growth to prices, although softer consumer demand has made pass-through more difficult in some industries. The key takeaway here is that domestic capacity pressures in both the housing and market services areas are contributing to above-target inflation. Despite a gradual easing over the past 18 months, the labour market remains relatively tight, with labour availability still a constraint for some businesses, and job vacancies remain elevated. We also continue to observe tightness across product markets, and firms report high capacity utilisation. Restrictive monetary policy has been working to bring demand and supply more into balance, and this has contributed to the easing in aggregate CPI inflation. Now, it's true that in some components of the CPI have eased more than others, but it isn't unusual for different components of inflation to behave differently at any point in time. At an aggregate level, clearly, there is still further to go. With underlying inflation having fallen very little over the past year in quarterly terms, the board is vigilant to the upside risks. That's why, as the board said in its August statement, policy will need to be sufficiently restrictive until we're confident that inflation is moving sustainably towards the target range. Now, we know that restrictive monetary policy settings that are necessary to bring inflation down are causing hardship to some households and businesses. We're very conscious of that. In fact, we spend a lot of time trying to understand how interest rates settings are affecting households and businesses, and I'll say a bit more about that later. But inflation causes hardship too, for all Australians, and particularly for the more vulnerable in our community. Our experience of how costly inflation can be is the reason getting inflation back to the target range is our priority. There's two ways to come at this. The first is taking a longer view. Remind ourselves why we have a flexible inflation targeting framework. And that goes back to our experience with high inflation in the 1970s and 1980s. Inflation, as measured by year-ended change in the CPI, reached 17.7% in March 75, and it remained around about 10% on average for the rest of the 1970s and the early 1980s. For those who experienced it, memories of that period may have faded. They've faded for me. And for many younger people, it probably seems like ancient history, but institutions can preserve the lessons of the past. The move to flexible inflation targeting by many central banks in the 1990s embodied the strong consensus at the time that inflation was harmful and that the way monetary policy had operated in the 1980s hadn't been sufficient for many central banks to bring inflation down. High and variable inflation is harmful because it raises uncertainty and makes it harder to plan for the future. It can distort economic activity, affecting decisions about investment and employment, ultimately hurting productivity and household incomes. For example, it might be hard for a firm to lock in a supply contract if it doesn't know what prices are going to do over the next year. In turn, this might make it harder to make expansion plans for the business. High and variable inflation also can cause shifts in people's wealth and spending power. Agreeing to a new contract or making savings plans is harder if you don't know how expensive things will be in the future. High inflation also eventually requires disinflation, and that can have long-lasting costs for households through higher unemployment. So setting a clear and transparent inflation target has helped to guide the Reserve Bank Board's decision-making. But it's also provided a clear anchor for inflation expectations, resulting in lower and more stable inflation. Over the inflation targeting period, well-anchored inflation expectations have enabled monetary policy to more effectively respond to the ups and downs of the economic cycle, stabilising the economy and creating the conditions for steady growth and job creation. Now, the anchor has held through the most recent inflation episode, but we do not and we cannot take that for granted. Over time, inflation expectations will only remain aligned with the target if we continually work to return inflation there when it moves too far up or down. The time frame over which we can do so, it does vary, and because we also take account of our full employment objective. But over the medium term, our full employment goal is best served by achieving the inflation target. Now, the second way to come at the question of why getting inflation down is the board's priority is to look at the effects that high inflation has had on people over the past 3 years. Every Australian feels the effects of inflation, but people have different patterns of spending and incomes, and so their experience of cost of living pressures varies. Lower income households tend to allocate more of their spending towards essentials, including food, utility bills, and rent. Higher income households tend to spend more on owner-occupied housing, as well as discretionary items such as consumer durables. Through most of the recent inflationary period, inflation has been broadly based across most components of the CPI basket. So most people have experienced similar rates of increase in inflation. However, inflation for non-discretionary items has eased, but it remains elevated in recent quarters. This partly reflects housing inflation, as we talked about earlier. Lower income households tend to spend a larger share of their income on rents, and so this is likely to be a greater challenge for this segment of our community. The experience of households, individual households, varies widely, but younger households and lower income households have been particularly affected by cost of living pressures overall. They're often budget constrained and they have less scope to reduce their spending on discretionary items to balance their budget. They also might have less scope to reduce spending via trading down to cheaper items within the same category. If they were already purchasing those lower cost items, there's nowhere to go. Moreover, they typically have smaller savings buffers, and so there's less scope to use savings to maintain their current standard of living. We know that if high inflation becomes entrenched in the expectations of firms and households, it would be difficult, more difficult and costly to reduce. If businesses and workers come to expect that prices and wages will continue rising quickly, this adds to inflationary pressures, requiring even higher interest rates to bring inflation down. Ultimately, we'd need to slow the economy down by more, which would result in a larger rise in unemployment and a higher risk of recession. The cost of job loss is very high to individual workers, and it leads to persistent earnings losses. This experience is consistent across groups of workers, but job losses tend to be disproportionately borne by some members of our community: the young, those that are less educated, and people on lower incomes and with less wealth, including renters. A weak labour market also hurts those who keep their jobs, whether through a reduction in hours worked or through lower wages growth. So the future costs to not containing inflation would be borne by all Australians, but disproportionately by lower income households. Now, I've noted on a number of occasions that monetary policy needs to be set for aggregate economic conditions, but we only have one interest rate, one instrument, it's the interest rate, and that's the only thing we have to impact demand, and it's blunt. It is blunt. But just as inflation is felt differently by various groups in the community, so too are interest rate moves. So we therefore need to pay close attention to conditions facing different parts of the community, including the most vulnerable. That's true when thinking about monetary policy and also when thinking about financial stability. So the RBA's forthcoming September financial stability review will provide an overall assessment of the health of household and business finances. I don't want to steal the FSR's thunder, but I do want to conclude today by previewing a few key messages on how household finances are faring. The first thing to say is that I understand the board's message on interest rates is one that not many borrowers want to hear. Those with mortgages are feeling the squeeze on their cash flows, not just from high inflation, but also from the increase in interest rates that's occurred in response to it. And as labour market conditions ease, more households will experience a strain on their finance from unemployment or reduced working hours. Information received from the RBA's liaison program indicates that more people than usual are seeking support from community organisations, and often for the first time. In the FSR, we tend to focus on households with mortgages because debt has the potential to amplify and transmit stress across the financial system. A key point to make here is that despite the pressure on household budgets, only a small share of borrowers is currently at risk of falling behind on their mortgage repayments. The key reasons for this are that the labour market has been strong, people have been able to find and stay in work, and many have been making adjustments to their spending, particularly on discretionary items. I can't quite see the graphs. For owner-occupiers with variable rate loans, which is a subset of all borrowers, we estimate that around 5% are in a particularly challenging situation, where the combined total of their essential spending and scheduled mortgage repayments is more than their income. That is, they have a cash flow shortfall. Now, although this group is fairly small overall, those in it have to make some quite painful adjustments to avoid falling behind on their mortgage repayments. This includes things like cutting back on their spending to the more essential items, trading down to lower quality goods and services, dipping into their savings, or working extra hours. And some may ultimately have to make the very difficult choice to sell their home. A really important point to note here is that lower income borrowers are overrepresented in the group of people who are really struggling. If inflation were to remain higher for longer than the RBA is forecasting, the share of borrowers at risk of being unable to service their debts would increase a little further. While the numbers aren't large enough to pose a material risk to the stability of the financial system, it would have a material impact on those households who end up in this situation. And we know that lower income borrowers are most at risk of this because they typically have smaller financial buffers. So in conclusion, let me try to summarise. Look, inflation has not been as high as it has recently been for a few decades, and I think many people have forgotten how bad it is. And for those of you under the age of 40, you probably not have apart from the last couple of years, you probably haven't experienced high inflation at all. There is a reason why there's so much talk about the cost of living. High inflation hurts everyone, and especially the most vulnerable. It reduces what people can buy with their wages, it erodes the value of savings, and it disproportionately hurts those people on lower incomes and fixed incomes. This is why it's imperative we return inflation to levels that mean it's in the background again, at which point it won't be any longer distorting the economy. We see achieving our inflation target as going hand in hand with our full employment objective, as it lays the foundations for economic growth and jobs creation. The board is seeking to balance reducing inflation in a reasonable time frame and maintaining as many of the gains in the labour market that we have seen in the past few years as possible. Ultimately, though, it's crucial to remember that our full employment goal is not served by letting inflation stay above the target indefinitely. Thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. And in particular, thanks for sharing insights around the distributional impact and particularly focusing on lower income households and more vulnerable Australians. As I said earlier, Michelle is taking questions. We've got 15 minutes. There's two microphones. I'm going to start with the left-hand side. If you can say your name, the organisation you're from, and keep your questions succinct. Thank you.
Thank you, Bess. Hugh Remington from Channel 10. Our audience that watches our news, they're not economists, they're people with mortgages or people who hope to get them. So in terms that they would understand, given that the national accounts have shown that household consumption has undershot significantly the Reserve Bank's forecasts, they might wonder, in simple terms, if they are spending less, according to the national accounts, why are you not adjusting down your predictions about what you'll do with interest rates?
In simple terms, Hugh, it's the difference between growth rates and levels. So it's true that the growth rate of GDP has slowed. GDP itself was around about where we forecast it would be, but the components were a little different. Consumption was a little softer. But part of monetary policy's job has been to try and slow the growth of the economy because the level of demand for goods and services in the economy is higher than the ability of the economy to supply those goods and services. So there's still a gap there. So even though it's slowing, we still have this gap. And part of that is because the supply side of the economy isn't performing as well, and productivity is part of that. And part of it is that demand was so strong coming out of the pandemic that its level is still above the ability of the economy to supply the goods and services. That's why inflation is still there. So I understand why people would think that as things are slowing, that should be a reason to lower interest rates. But we need to see the results in inflation before we can do that.
Let's go to Jonathan.
Thank you, Governor. Jonathan Kearns from Challenger. You talked about the RBA's consideration of both inflation and full employment objectives. The RBA review recommend that they be given equal consideration, but then the government didn't take that on board, so it's still at the discretion of the RBA in effect. So I was wondering how you or the board or the staff come about in determining what the relative importance to inflation and output objectives should be, given it's seemingly quite different for the RBA to other central banks and has been important in determining the path of interest rates.
Hmm. I'd actually have to say I think the Fed seems to have a fairly similar narrative to us as well, actually, in terms of the employment side of the mandate. There's no science to it, Jonathan, as you probably understand. What we've been trying to do is manage the excess demand down to a point where it's not recessionary. So unlike some other countries where they now have a negative output gap, in effect, So their supply is higher than their demand. We're trying to do something which means managing down the excess demand to a point where it's just in line with supply. And that's sort of the way we're trying to balance the two objectives. I think it would be quite easy to imagine, and you've seen it in some countries. In some countries, that they are seeing, I'm thinking Canada, I'm thinking New Zealand, they've seen their unemployment rate rise quite sharply. So I would argue they were a bit more restrictive than us. We're restrictive, but they're a bit more restrictive. So we are somehow trying to manage this process to keep enough restriction in to bring demand down, but not to the extent that it ends up in oversupply. I'm not sure that quite answers your question. There's no scientific way of doing this, but we're attentive to both. Having said that, if inflation doesn't come down, then it might be that the best medicine is, in fact, that we have to end up putting more restriction into the economy.
Let's go over on this side to keep it fair.
Thank you, Governor. Penry Buckley from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. You spoke again about, as you say, what your predecessor describes as the narrow path the RBA is navigating between bringing down inflation and holding on to labour market gains. But the Treasurer used less generous language this week when he said that successive rate hikes under the RBA were smashing the economy. Do you feel that public criticism by the Treasurer and others of the RBA and high rates is fair?
I understand that people are hurting from high interest rates. I do understand that. But I think, as I tried to set out in the speech, it's actually high inflation that is really causing trouble for people, and it's causing trouble for the most vulnerable. It's affecting everyone. So the role of interest rates in this is to try and temper demand. That's what monetary policy does. And it's working. It's clearly working. But we need to see the results in the inflation numbers. That's what we need to see, inflation coming down, because as I said in the speech and characterised in the speech, if we don't get inflation down, it's bad for everyone, absolutely everyone. So that's the job I'm focusing on, that's the job the board is focusing on, and I really think the board thinks at the moment we're still on that narrow path. That's what we're trying to achieve.
So were those comments unfair then, would you say?
I have no comment to make on the comments.
Peter Hannon from The Guardian. And just to follow up slightly from my colleague there, from the comments you've made in your speech today, debt arrears not particularly picking up, maybe that 5%, it seems steady with significant challenges. That would imply from your comments you do not think that the economy is being smashed, just to be clear, as the Treasurer has suggested. My actual follow-up question, the one I was going to ask. Central bank forecasts, as you noted in your speech, are predicated on market expectations for the cash rate. But because the board sets the cash rate, you, in a way, can load the dice. And so my question is, do you have a model output run based on where you think the cash rate is actually going to be? And does that produce a different outcome for, say, how high the jobless rate is going to go? I think the highest in the August SMP was 4.4%. But you keep saying interest rates unlikely to rise in the near term. The market is factoring that in. So I'm just wondering whether you have a different outcome about where the RBA thinks the actual cash rate path will be.
We have models, obviously, which have various cash rate, and you can put various cash rate paths in and you can reverse engineer them. You could say, if I want inflation down to the target range by middle of next year, then what would the model imply the cash rate target has to do? But again, I want to come back to that fan chart there. These models and these central projections are subject to a great deal of uncertainty and error. So we don't... As you get closer, obviously, you get more certain, but going that far out, it's very difficult. So, yes, we can do that exercise. And in the statement on monetary policy, we did have some scenarios which had some different paths for unemployment and consumption. And some of those could be paths that have different interest rate scenarios in them as well. So it all depends on... I think the models itself, you would typically use more, I think, for reverse engineering what you wanted to achieve in inflation. And you would have to, I think you would see, I can't give you specifics because I don't know the actual numbers, but if you wanted to put in a cash rate path that generated a return to inflation much more quickly, then my suspicion is yes, it would increase the end unemployment rate.
Thank you. Joseph Hathaway-Wilson from the ABC. Given the RBA has just one blunt instrument, as you put it, in interest rates, does the federal government need to be doing more to bring down inflation?
The federal government and the Treasurer said a number of times that he's doing his bit to try and bring down inflation. My job is to focus on what I can do, which is only the interest rate. I think all the governments are conscious of it because, quite frankly, all of their constituents are suffering from high inflation. So I think they are focused on it.
Governor Phil O'Donoghue from Deutsche Bank, thank you so much for your remarks today. You told us again that you're vigilant to upside risks on inflation, and you started your speech by showing us your forecast for trim mean inflation. For my sins, I look very closely at that chart, and if I get a ruler out, you're looking for 3.5% year ended for Q3 2024. If it's 3.6 or above, will you hike?
I couldn't tell you that, Phil.
I knew you wouldn't.
The board isn't going to focus on one single number. They're going to focus on the breadth of information that they are receiving. Yes, the inflation numbers will be one, but there's also activity, there's labour market data, so I couldn't say.
Thank you. Worth a try.
Amelia Brace from Seven News, thank you for your time. Back to the smashing the economy comments from Jim Chalmers. The opposition leader has said today that you and the Treasurer are at war. Are you?
To ring the bell.
He's doing his job and I'm doing mine. I wouldn't use those sorts of words.
Thank you. Let's go over here.
Governor Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. Variation of the same theme, but slightly less confrontational. Do you think the trajectory of the state and federal government spending is sustainable?
Yes, so... slightly less confrontational. look, this I've said a number of times in the past, and I've said it to the Parliament as well, government spending is not actually the main game here. I think as we saw in the national accounts yesterday, consumption is really weak. Now, we are looking for a recovery in consumption. But if that doesn't occur, then that's actually going to be a really important piece of information, and it's also going to be really important for the inflation outcomes. So I think basically we should be focusing on the breadth of what's happening in the economy, demand as in total demand, and not focusing on individual components and thinking about what that means for the inflationary pressures in the economy.
Governor Tom Dusevic from The Australian. One inelegant interpretation of your speech might be that high inflation is smashing the economy. Yesterday's national accounts showed that household sector is doing it pretty tough at the moment. Do you think it's possible that the actual cure for demand being so high of restrictive monetary policy is actually worse than the problem of high inflation?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that high interest rates are worse than the problem of high inflation. I think what I tried to demonstrate in the speech today was that high inflation hurts everyone, and it hurts the most vulnerable the most, to repeat what I said in the speech. And for those reasons, using interest rates to bring inflation back down to target is absolutely worth achieving that. Now, I should say that, you know, back to the narrow path point, we've tried to raise interest rates to get them restrictive enough to bring inflation back down to target without overdoing it. And we've been sometimes criticised for that. Some people have said, you should have gone as far as the Fed's gone. We haven't. We've tried to maintain an interest rate that is as high enough as it needs to be to bring inflation back down. And I do believe, and I know the board believes, that that is the best course of action.
We'll take two more questions, one here, and then we'll end with Rory, who's often a feature of our ABA events. So over here.
Thank you. My name's Max. I'm actually just here as an individual. I'm not representing any institution. But I'd like to thank you for your speech today and also your address to the House of Representatives last month. And I think many people also appreciate your emphasis on the construction sector and the rising costs and the shortage of labour. But given most materials in construction come from imports from overseas, is the weakening of the Australian dollar or movements in the Australian dollar in the future going to be a consideration of the board when looking at interest rates?
So the exchange, the floating exchange rate is good in the sense that it gives us the ability to set our own monetary policy based on domestic conditions. So we've got a bit of flexibility. Having said that, when setting interest rates, it might have implications for the exchange rate depending on what other countries are doing with their interest rates as well. So yes, we do have to take that into account because it does have impacts on inflation. At the moment, though, with other countries easing or looking like they're going to ease and us sort of staying where we are, the pressures are probably in the other direction for the exchange rate, keeping it slightly more elevated, which is positive for inflation, so and potentially and therefore positive for import costs as well. So,
thank you.
Good afternoon. Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Michelle, thanks for your presentation. For many years, there was only one monthly CPI indicator, and that was published by the Melbourne Institute, which is the entity that produces the HILDA data, which is highly regarded. I was never in love with the Melbourne Institute CPI measure, but it does seem to track quite well the big trends in inflation. Now, it was below 2% for the sort of pre-pandemic period. It surged to 6.5%, and it came down to 4%. And then in the later 6 months, it's come right back down to 2.5% in August. So my question is, does the Reserve Bank follow that measure to keep track that measure, and doesn't see anything promising, potentially signalling that inflation may fall sooner rather than later to where the Reserve Bank wants it?
Yeah, we do follow that measure, obviously, and we also follow the monthly variability in the ABS monthly indicator as well. We don't read a lot into, well, we read some information from that, and we read some information from the Melbourne Institute, but really, the comprehensive CPI is the best we've got in judging what's happening, particularly to these particular categories which we're focusing on at the moment, the things that are really holding inflation up. So, yes, it's slightly encouraging, but again, over the last year, we haven't seen much progress on disinflation. So we really need to be convinced that we're going to see it in the actual numbers before we, and we are going sustainably back to target before we think about reducing interest rates.
So the official Q3 CPI on the 30th of October is the next good inflation indicator?
It's one indicator, and it's we will obviously be looking closely at it, but there'll be other things we'll be taking into consideration as well. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.